We are now going to begin letter 18, part number 4, starting from page 272. And now, today, when this aspect of the worldly mentality has already lost its vitality, we are left with two generations confronting each other. Now, when he says it lost its vitality, he's referring to the fact that people today are not into thinking as much about these things, and we're just dealing with the results. So one of them, and this refers to the traditional old school type of Judaism, which is unable to deal with Judaism or bring it to life for the modern crowd. So one of them has inherited an uncomprehended Judaism as mitzvahs anashim milimada, practice by men from habit, a revered but lifeless mummy, which it is afraid to bring back to life. The other, and this refers to Reform Judaism, though in part burning with noble enthusiasm for the welfare of the Jews, regards Judaism as bereft of any life and spirit, a relic of an era long past and buried, and tries to uncover its spirit, but, not finding it, threatens, through its well-meant efforts, to sever the last life nerve of Judaism out of sheer ignorance. So this refers to Revelation at Sinai, our oral tradition, the binding characteristic of the Torah and its commandments. So today, when these two extremes approach each other in a thousand variations, and thereby testify to the fact that they are both in error, where do we go from here? Now, when he says that they're both in error, obviously the errors aren't equal. One stands with Torah, but doesn't know how to make it palatable and how to pass it on. The other doesn't stand with Torah, but possesses a burning desire and passion. Where lies the way to salvation? Will it do to build our schools and reform our divine service on such a splintered foundation? No. The spirit is lacking, the inner, unifying principle of life, and one can never make up for that by polishing the outward forms. There is but one road that leads to salvation. Amends must be made precisely where the wrong was done. We must forget the views and prejudices that we inherited about Judaism and instead turn to the sources of Judaism, the Tanakh, the Talmud, and the Midrash. Now, Rav Hirsch stresses that Midrash should be taught, and we quoted earlier an essay that he wrote on what the correct manner of teaching Midrash is. We must read, study, and comprehend them in order to live by them, and to draw from them Judaism's views about God, the world, mankind, and Yisrael, seen in the light of its destiny and the law given to it. Thus, Judaism must be studied and understood out of itself, as we've said many times, without foreign philosophies, and be elevated all by itself to a science of wise living. Let us begin with the Tanakh. First of all, come to know its language and elicit from the spirit of the language the spirit of its speaker. The Tanakh should not be read for purposes of philological or antiquarian research, fanciful theories, or entertainment. It should be studied as the foundation of a new science. Let us look at nature as King David did. Let us listen to the march of history with the intent ear of the prophet Yeshaya. And with eyes thus opened and ears thus attuned, let us draw from the Tanakh our lessons about God, the world, mankind, Yisrael, and the Torah. So through Torah, we will see and understand the world and the mission of mankind. Then, having formulated this fundamental conception of Judaism, let us study the Talmud in this spirit. Let us look at the halacha as merely expounding the basic conception drawn from the Tanakh. So let's see Rabbi Elias's note 28. And he writes, the author had previously criticized the pursuit of Talmudic pilpul as an end in itself. Torah study is meant to lead to action. Hence, he defines the goal of Talmud study as the concrete, practical implementation of the basic ideas gained from Tanakh. While the Tanakh defines the meaning of life and man's task, the oral law provides the specific halachic and philosophical guidance needed. In stating that Agada and Halacha merely express the fundamental teachings of Tanakh, the author did not mean to downgrade the study of the oral tradition, but rather to stress the inner unity of the written and oral law, a concept that was intensely challenged by the Reformers. Let us see in the Agada merely the expression of the same spirit disguised in allegorical form. Do not be concerned about the opinion that one school of thought or the other may hold regarding your studies. Do not be concerned that, in following your simple approach, you will no longer be able to excel among the heroes of disputations devoted to hair-splitting rather than truth and life. Now, this is a pretty open diss to the old school of orthodoxy that spent much of their time on pilpul rather than the practical aspects of life. And he will not be able to enter academic debates, which was kind of a knock on reform, for whom academia was everything. After all, they called it the science of Judaism. And it's normal for one to feel that what he's doing is incorrect when the rest of society that he looks up to, or at least is swayed by, rejects what he is doing. Do not be concerned if you will no longer be able to shine in the various branches of learning, which you will now study merely as aids to your primary pursuits, and if you will be unable to put on beguiling displays of scholarship. After all, you are discovering the way to the light of truth, to the warmth and heights of life, and once you have arrived there, you will understand Yisrael's destiny and its teachings, and will comprehend life itself as the reflection of these teachings, totally permeated by their spirit. One spirit pervades everything, from the structure of the language to the actions that structure our lives. One spirit, infused by the spirit of the One alone. So just like Hashem is one, so too we must also try to be completely one in every aspect of our lives, and we already played Rabbi Wein on this idea. Just to backtrack slightly, we stated that these teachings are totally permeated by their spirit. So the generations that followed Rav Hirsch's model were known for their very clear conviction and hashkafos of what is true, correct, and what is demanded of them. We could say that they knew their duties well, and furthermore, they were able to impart this knowledge successfully from one generation to the next due to their clear understanding of Torah and the Derech Eretz that was around them. In other words, the challenges of life and what they were dealing with. They were master mechanchim, and they followed their master mechanich, Rav Hirsch. And we know they also had a very high success rate at integrating all the demands of Torah in the aspects of their everyday work lives, vacation, etc. And this was the result of being totally permeated by this new spirit that Rav Hirsch called them to. Now, that might sound like a lot of fluff, but do I have any source I can use to back up what I'm saying? So yes, let's look at the Sridei Eishes Tshuva on German Jews being master mechanchim. And this is something that the Eastern European Jewish community lacked. So Sridei Eish died in the 1960s, so he really got to see the result of Rav Hirsch's Torah Derech Eretz really put into play. And this comes from Shailos Uchuvos Sridei Eish, Chelek Beis, Simin Ches. He writes as follows: Ugedole Ashkenaz, hayu bikim umumchim b'chachma sachinoch. The Gedolim of Ashkenaz were experts, they were proficient in the skill of education. V'lachin hitzlichu b'ma'aseihem, they were successful in their work, meaning education. L'hakim doros shelemim shel ba'alei yarei shamayim v'haschala chilonis ke'echad. They were able to establish full generations of yarei shamayim and people with outstanding knowledge, meaning general knowledge. Mashalo Allah bide geone gedoli litu Poland. Unlike the gedolim of Lithuania and Poland, they were not as successful in this area. Lefi shalo yadu lechonin es hachinuch al pitnei hazman, because they didn't know how to establish education based on the needs of the time. V'yadua mashe siper hagon of Yisrael Salanter b'shuvo me'ashkenaz. So it's well known, the story of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter when he returned from Germany. V'sham nizdamin im Rav Israel Hildesheimer, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and there he met with Rav Hildesheimer. V'ra also miratze shiurim b'tanach v'shulchan aruch lifnei nashim tz'iros u'besulos, and he saw Rav Hildesheimer was lecturing women in Tanakh and Shulchan Aruch and to Rabbi Yisrael. This looked very, very foreign. V'cho Amar, and this is what Rabbi Yisrael said, Im Yavo, Me Mirabani Lita, Lahani Kain Ba'adoso, if one of the Rabbanim in Lithuania would come to conduct himself like Rav Hildesheimer is doing right now, teaching Torah publicly to women, Vadai Sheya'aviru Osil Mikehunaso, we would fire him immediately. V'chein Hadin, and really, Alpi Halacha, that's what you should do. Mikol Makom, Halevai Sheyehe Chelki B'gan Eden, Im Hagona Tzadik Rav Ezriel Hildesheimer. He says, I wish, though, that my portion in the world to come was like that of Rav Hildesheimer. Now, if you look through other parts of the Tshuva, you'll see Rav Hirsch is mentioned as well, and we know Rav Hildesheimer, to a large degree, followed, and as did most of Germany, followed, on some level, Rav Hirsch's understanding of Torah im Derech Haaretz. Here is a worthy subject for the disciples of scholarly study. But the result of such study must be carried over into life, implanted by schools, schools for Jews. The young saplings of our people must be reared as Jews, as sons and daughters of Judaism, which you have now recognized and understood, and have learned to respect and love as the essence of your life. They should master the language of the Tanakh, just as they do that of their country, and they should be taught to think in both tongues. Their hearts should be trained to feel, their minds to think. The books of the Tanakh should become the source of their instruction for life, and they should learn to hear their message throughout their lives. Their eyes should be open to see the world surrounding them as God's world, and themselves as God's servants in His world. Their ears should be open to perceive history as a process of educating all mankind toward the service of God. Yeah, imagine how different Jewish people would be if they would keep this in mind. Then, they have to be taught, by means of Torah and Talmud, to see their lives as a totally inspired service of God, to be understood, respected, and loved, so that they will rejoice to bear the name Jew, and to follow the way of life that this name brings with it, despite all ridicule and privations. The preparation for breadwinning should be included in the program of such schooling for life, just as breadwinning itself will later on be a part of life, as a means to a full life, not as an end in itself. Let the pupils be taught to judge the value of a life, not by the social status, wealth, or splendor achieved, but according to whether it is a life-given inner content by dedication to the service of God. Let them understand that the demands of such dedication should not be subordinated to the pull of sensual pleasures and natural indolence. Indolence is laziness, but that the reverse should be the case. Now, Rav Hirsch here discusses the preparation for breadwinning, and it is important that one should have a means for parnasa. That is a part of a commandment of a Jew, is that you should be able to provide for your family. But even more importantly, that one's occupation should be fully run by Torah. So let's see what Rav Hirsch says about this in Chorev, in paragraph 552. This is in the chapter entitled Education. Capacity to earn a living and support himself. The attainments, which are to fit the child for its future career, must include also such knowledge and skill as will one day assure him the possibility of becoming self-supporting, as you have been, also of forming a circle round himself and bringing into it possessions of his own, and from this circle and with these possessions of living a full life of justice and love, and so transmitting it to the next generation what he has received from you. Therefore, you, obviously the father, have to take thought that your child will be provided with some business, some craft, some art, some profession according to his disposition. All are equally worthy, provided they are honest and honorable. If you can, however, follow the recommendation of our sages and choose one which depends on his own personal skill, like a handicraft or a trade, and which therefore is not too much at the mercy of circumstances. As for making a living out of scholarship, our sages did not know of such a thing. They considered it a denigration of the sanctity of learning, for learning was their very life. Nay, it was originally forbidden to take money for teaching the wisdom of the Torah. Only the pressure and circumstances and the crying needs of the Torah itself brought about a change, which is understandable. but be particularly careful to choose no career that endangers the child's morality and Jewishness. While, however, this training for earning a living is unquestionably a father's duty, beware of seeing in it the whole of that duty and of thinking that you have done enough if your child is able to keep body and soul together by his own efforts or even to set up house. Of what use are a living and a home to him if his spirit is unilluminated, if he knows how to make a living but not how to live as a Jew? To train your child for earning a living is a part of your parental duties, but only the last of them, emphatically not the first or the most important, much less the whole. Continuing, also, until the time that Yisrael's homes will have been erected by such sons and daughters of Yisrael, parents must be entreated, implored, not to undermine the work of the school, and not to crush and choke the tender shoots of Jewish feeling in their children's hearts by an icy cold and unsympathetic attitude. Indeed, the latent noble sentiments in the parents' own hearts should be awakened and, where it is too late to gain their understanding, at least their respect should be attained. If this program were realized, surely things could be different in Yisrael. So we have 2 points here. The first point is that parents have to work not to undermine the school. So I'd like to read an essay on this from Rav Breuer. This is entitled School and Home, and it was put out in March of 1965. There is little that is really new in the field of school-home relationship, yet it seems entirely in place to reassert the actuality of old truths that are frequently ignored or even forgotten. School and home complement each other. For this reason, the constructive cooperation between school and home is of utmost importance. In a spirit of goodwill, parents must devote their wholehearted interest to the school to which they entrust their children. It does not mean that they are not entitled to submit requests, suggestions, even criticism of school procedure. All this is welcome, provided that the contact is made with the proper authorities, administrators or teachers, and that the required respect is maintained at all times. If the student complains at home of an incident in school, and the parents, as adults, recognize the complaint to be without foundation, they will not hesitate to reject it. If they are in doubt, they will listen quietly to the complaint and will carefully avoid voicing any judgment or opinion in front of the child. If necessary, they will make contact with the school authorities. They will never allow remarks by the child that are disrespectful of the school, school authorities, and teachers. They will scrupulously suppress any negative or destructive criticism of the school and its personnel in front of the child. For would it not be a betrayal of their all-important role as parents were they to cause their own children to lose respect of, and thereby confidence in, the school and its teachers? Respect and trust are vital ingredients of the healthy relationship between the students and the principal and teachers. On them depend discipline and the positive attitude towards the curriculum. While I certainly agree with what Rav Breuer is saying, I could imagine that for a lot of parents this would be extremely difficult. Frequently, the school will seek the assistance of the home if the student's conduct and effort are unsatisfactory. For the school depends greatly on the influence and guidance emanating from parental home. By the same token, the school must scrupulously avoid any action or approach that might in any manner serve to weaken the child's respect of and trust in the parent. So just as an aside, you could find in some of the more modern schools, you'll have students who have secular names. And when they walk into class, the first thing the Hebrew teacher will say is, "Oh, what's your Hebrew name?" As if there's something wrong with them having a secular name. That, to me, weakens a child's respect of their parents who gave them a certain name. So I think it's something that a school should keep in mind. By helping to promote the child's respect and love for the school, parents in reality help themselves. For the issue is not only the child's conduct and achievement in school. It is often desirable, even vital, that the home request the help of the school in order to improve the child's attitude and relationship at home. Parents will have themselves to reproach if their own negative relationship to the school and its teachers and the inevitably resulting deterioration of the child's respect for school deprives them of the invaluable help the school is able to offer them when problems arise at home. To repeat, in their own interest and in the interest of their children, parents should scrupulously avoid any critical appraisal of the school and its staff in front of their children. In their children's interest, they will wholeheartedly support the work of the school, will refrain from tearing down its reputation by irresponsible discussions at street corners and at social gatherings, will refrain from building up minor incidents into major issues, and will confine their criticism to the proper channels, in the proper light, and in the proper manner. These appear to be self-understood requirements, yet it seems necessary to impress them again and again on the consciousness of the parent body. Now, it should be noted here that this essay is dealing with Frum parents and with Orthodox parents, and Rav Hirsch was not. Rav Hirsch wanted that the feelings and the sentiments of the children that they would learn in school and would express would trickle up to the parents and have the parents become more involved. Now, the second point we mentioned in this paragraph was that if this program were realized, surely things could be different in Yisrael. Let us read a little bit about this program, and we'll start with note 34 from Rabbi Elias on page 309. He writes, in the preceding pages, Rav Hirsch laid down the outlines of an educational program for Jewish schools, presented at greater length and in more detail in Chorev, chapter 84. This program flows from the author's view of the task of the Jew in this world, as developed in the 19 letters, and is summarized below. Number 1. Torah study is to be preeminent and should be pursued according to the pattern set by our sages in Avos 5:25. First, there must be a thorough study of Torah and Nach, the sources of our wisdom and our understanding of life and the world, together with the practical rules for Jewish living. Then, the child should proceed to an intensive study of Mishnah, by which Rav Hirsch means not just perusal of the text, but mastery of the whole range of halachic subjects dealt with in the Mishnah, and an understanding of the governing principles of the oral law. Thus prepared, the student should find it easy to progress to a mastery of the Talmud, not the cultivation of pilpul for its own sake, to be sure, but to a clear knowledge and understanding of Shas. Clearly, Rav Hirsch did not envision a superficial reading of the Talmud texts. Thus, he stressed due attention to the Rishonim, such as Rashba and Ran. 2. General knowledge concerning nature and history, man and society, also should be pursued, as well as the practical and vocational skills discussed in note 32 above. These studies should not be viewed as mere concessions to the exigencies of life, for they are needed to help us shape the world according to God's will. The author's essay on the relation between Jewish and general education defined more specifically the function of the pursuit of Derech Eretz, example, to acquire skills such as astronomy needed for halachic purposes, to see God's work in nature and history, to prepare to earn a clean and easy livelihood, in the words of our sages, to be able to relate and respond to the cultural atmosphere surrounding us, and to deal with the ideological challenges that we have to confront. The role of Derech Eretz is by no means an insignificant one. He quotes here from Vayikra Rabba, the sages designated the road that leads to the tree of life as Derech Eretz, as the way of culture, of social refinement which results from people living together in the world, as being the first tutor and educator to morals, manners, and order. Derech Eretz preceded the giving of the Torah by 26 generations and is a prerequisite to it. That is why the Jew rejoices whenever and wherever culture elevates people to a perception of true values and nurtures goodness. But of course, where culture and civilization are used in the service of sensuality, the degeneration only gets all the greater. However, such misuse of culture does not do away with the intrinsic value and blessing of Derech Eretz. Therefore, Jews, too, are to attach themselves to and love all good and true culture, and show that being a Jew is only a higher stage of being a man. And of course, on the other hand, if culture and education, instead of leading to Torah, seek to replace it, then this does not lead to the tree of life, but to degeneration. So Rabbi Elias continues, it follows that general studies must stand in a very specific relationship to our primary objective, the pursuit of Torah. If they do not serve this purpose, and at most are viewed as separate vocational pursuits, they should not be undertaken according to Rav Hirsch. As our sages stressed, he who puts God's name together with something else will be uprooted from this earth. Secular studies must not be something else, but must be viewed and used as tools for our Torah life. That also means, however, that they can in no way be considered equal in importance to Torah studies. Torah is to be accorded an absolute, unchallengeable priority, a priority in quantity, in quality, and first and foremost in time. And that's a quote from Mordechai Breuer. Now, of course, we have stressed again and again that the secular studies are a tefillah and are subordinate to Torah. Now, if we skip to the next page, Rabbi Elias quotes Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, the Sri De'esh. He writes, "The Sri De'esh has remarked that no religious Jew can accept the idea that he is not fully cultured if he only learns a lot of Torah, or that for the enrichment of his personality, he has to seek culture apart from Torah. Nowhere in Rav Hirsch's writings is there one word that would suggest that he views Judaism and human culture as complementary values. Always again, he stresses that Judaism itself is the highest form of human culture, since it is not merely a ceremonial law, but seeks to embrace and possess the entire human being. Torah is for Hirsch the formative force which is to pervade his entire existence. Every human feeling, every human endeavor can be Jewish, provided that it is felt and carried out Jewishly. Art, science, work should all be pervaded by the power of Torah." Rav Hirsch clearly spells out his position. Our approach to what is called science is entirely different from that of the nations of the world. They seek solutions to their questions through free and creative inquiry, through contemplation of nature and history. Israel, on the other hand, seeks to understand the meaning and development of all the interwoven relationships of creation and mankind in the light of the truth that was revealed to us at Sinai. Any other approach poses danger. Rabbi Weinberg therefore stresses that obviously Rav Hirsch could not accept contemporary culture unless and until it had passed the test of Judaism. Okay, now the rest of Rabbi Elias's note is very long, and he goes on to discuss different issues concerning the permissibility of secular studies, and it would appear to me, as well as to others, that as the note proceeds, Rabbi Elias seems to do a switch, and he seems to downplay Rav Hirsch's stress of secular studies. And we already pointed out earlier that Rabbi Danziger kind of took Rabbi Elias to task for this. So at this point, we're going to leave that note where it is, and let's see if we could look into what Rav Hirsch's Torah education system was comprised of. So first, we're going to look at Rav Hirsch's commentary on Avos. This is in Perek He, Mishnah Chaf He. If, as specified in this passage, a boy by the time he has reached the age of 15 has behind him 10 years of Mikra, of Bible study, and 5 of Mishnah, he should have become so familiar with the basic truths of Judaism and with the fundamental concepts and requirements of our law that it should be an easy thing for him to make the transition to the commentaries, reasonings, and inferences contained in the Gemara, the work that completes the Torah. After 5 years spent in the study of Mishnah, no subject contained in the Gemara should be foreign to the young scholar. By this time, he should be able to follow all the debates in the Gemara with full comprehension and grasp their conclusions with ease. Let's take a look at one more source here. We'll look in Mishnaso Vishitaso by Rabbi Yonah Emanuel. This comes from page 155. Yeshna rak hatzala achas liyaldeinu. There's one thing that could save our children. V'hatzala zo hi lilmod? Lidog lekach sheyelamedu. Toshiv bincho l'ragli Moshe v'David. Place your sons at the feet of Moshe and David. Yishayu Malachi, Hillel v'Shamay, Abaye v'Ravo, Rith v'Rambam, Riv v'Rabbeinu Tam, Ramban Rashba v'Ran, Rosh v'Tur, Beis Yosef v'Rama, Yehuda Halevi, Rav Yaakov Arma, v'Rabbeinu Bechaye. So clearly we're talking about a pretty full breadth of Torah. Now Rav Hirsch's system is actually described more fully in Chorev and in some of his other writings, in the collective writings, for example. And if you will look at the syllabus for the teacher's seminary for Beis Yaakov, you'll also find that it's very comprehensive and really requires a large breadth of Torah. Let us continue. And things will be different in Yisrael. Our age is unmistakably leading to that. Do not view it with such gloom, my friend. True, it is a time of anxiety, like the hour of labor that precedes childbirth, but better the anxiety that prevails in the home of the mother-to-be than the freedom from anxiety, but also from joy and hope, in the home of the barren woman. This period of labor may well outlast our generation and that of our children. Who knows, even that of our grandchildren. But our great-grandchildren will rejoice in the newborn that will have struggled into life and light. The child whose name is Self-Comprehending Judaism. The assurance of this future can be found in our own age, in the striving to think, to understand, to grasp with our mind what it is that we should revere. Now, I would say that I don't think that today, in general, we think as much as they did necessarily in Rav Hirsch's time. In the Age of Enlightenment, thinking man was very much in the center. Today, we're a little looser about these things. Once the mind will have realized the futility of its groundless and aimless searching, and of its efforts to bargain with the overvalued claims of the passing moment, and once it will be realized that life can be built only on the basis of clear ideas and inwardly understood truth, we will then wake up to the questions. What does it mean that I am a Jew? And what is Judaism? To find the answer to these questions, we will then no longer turn to the lectures and dissertations of non-Jewish scholars who frequently see Judaism only through a distorting glass and who, in large part, believe that they have to obliterate the very spirit of Torah and Judaism in order to build their own ideological edifices. Nor shall we look for answers to our questions about Judaism in the writings of contemporary reformers who are motivated only by external considerations, or in the treatises of Jewish scholars holding basic viewpoints that stem from outside Judaism. We will go to the original source of Judaism, to the Tanakh and the Talmud, bringing to this study only one endeavor, to understand life through Judaism and to comprehend Judaism as the foundation for life. If this will be our only striving, it is bound to bring us to the ultimate goal, whereby understanding of the fundamentals of truth and life will lead to truth and life itself, in accordance with the old rule, now alas, nearly forgotten, l'lmod u'lamid, lishmor v'la'asos, to learn and to teach, to keep and to do. All of you who are still loyal to Judaism, who have inherited it as a matter of habit, and plan to hand it down again by habit, let your eyes be open to recognize that you will be able to transmit it only through its ideas. At least give your sons and daughters the sacred writings, the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ksuvim, so that the spirit throbbing in them may become their beacon of light and support in life. And you who are men of integrity among those who think they are working for the well-being of Judaism at this time, consider that you cannot give rise to new life merely by helping to loosen fetters from hand and foot and by stressing the adornment of fine clothing and outward appearance. Stay the hand that you have lifted to tear down the battlements of your faith. Reconsider whether you are not about to destroy an edifice that contains things sacred and eternal, treasures of life and truth, and that appears to you worthy only of the sledgehammer merely because it is covered by the dust of the centuries. Turn your eyes, which you averted, back to it again and examine once more just what it is that you are leaving behind. Surely the cause of Judaism is not at fault and should not suffer just because its champions, themselves covered with dust of battles against misery and oppression, could save it only covered with the grime of the past. I think most of this is self-understood. Let's continue. We, to whom the mildness of the times has given the task of removing this dust, should we have so little respect for the efforts and struggles of these men that we do not consider it worthwhile to cleanse this precious jewel for our own benefit, to discover what it is that they fought for? Should we just look at its dusty exterior and, solely because of that, cast away as worthless the precious possession for which our ancestors sacrificed life, property, and liberty, and all of life's joys? Should we? But I am forgetting, my dear Benjamin, that only heaven hears these wishes, that only this paper sees them, that I am writing only to you. Light and truth and life will emerge from these trying times. Be sure of it, my friend. And then you will see in a different light the situation which together we have been deploring, the seemingly hopeless state of the spiritual concerns of our people. There is no official leadership, no central authority, only efforts by individuals. As a result of the striving for reform, the religious services around which this whole movement for reform is apparently revolving have taken so many different forms that a Jew traveling through Germany can find a different service in every congregation. Rav Hirsch writes that if he had the power, he would close all shuls for a year in order that people should realize that it is not a shul that is essential to our lives, unlike a reform that had little else besides their synagogue services. Can you not see that this too has its positive side? So clearly, this would lead people to question, how could it be that every reform synagogue does what it pleases and what it wants? The veracity of the Torah should then come to the fore. And the positive side is that people could think for themselves, and Torah, being the ultimate truth, should win. If we look at the end of note 35, Rabbi Elias writes that Rav Hirsch had unbounded confidence in the truth of Torah and in the ultimate victory of the truth, but he also was aware of all the forces within and surrounding man which keep him from readily acknowledging the truth. Yet, even if he had had a choice and had opted for a central authority dedicated to the preservation of Torah, Rav Hirsch would still have insisted on the need to persuade, to reason, and to explain. Our own experience in our days shows that organized efforts to protect the practical and spiritual concerns of Torah Jewry and to reestablish the rule of Torah over the entire Jewish people, while no doubt extremely important, clearly have their limitations. Kirov Rechokim, regaining the souls that had been lost, is first and foremost a matter of education and inspiration. Just as an aside, I would add to that, that if you believe that Torah is the ultimate truth, and by educating, Torah will sell itself because it is the ultimate truth, then it would be great harm, as some organizations do, not to present Judaism in its absolute pristine truth and to try to change things around. If you believe what you have is true and correct, present it as it is. Let us continue. I am convinced that not one of us now living appreciates Judaism in its purity and truth. Take into account the differences of opinion, which are quite natural. Now here he is referring to how to approach and properly deal with modernity. Since every rabbi is obliged to find his own individual way and no school guides him, consider furthermore that we are passing through a period of birth throes, meaning for Judaism, and if some authority were to try to establish a definitive order at this stage, it would merely perpetuate the labor pains. For how might leaders be chosen now? If one-sided, they would perpetuate extreme approaches. If representing a mixture of trends, they would stand for compromises which would obstruct the tide of development that can bring the pure water of life only if it is allowed to run its full course. As matters stand now, however, whatever time has wrought, it will undo again, leaving space for the towering edifice that is waiting to be established. If, in the period after Maimonides, the serious concern for preserving the practical observance of Judaism had not made it necessary to curb conflicting philosophical tendencies, perhaps the exploration of all possible approaches might have led the Jewish mind to sober thought, and we might at this time have found ourselves at the point at which we can now expect to arrive only within centuries. Hence, I can only rejoice that now the scales are hanging free, held by God alone, and that only intellectual efforts struggle for balance, unimpeded in their swinging by forcible interference. Were they arrested again, our great-grandchildren would be no better off than we are. Should we not, for their sake, be unafraid to go through these times of anxiety? By all means, let the scales swing. And just to summarize what we're about to say, once Yisrael fully understands itself and is fulfilling its purpose, then Christianity will also recognize Hashem's rulership. So let's see, the more freely they hang, the more reliably they will assess truth and life in the end, the more violently they must swing at this time. But once the scales have come to rest, the spirit of Yisrael will stand revealed in its full brilliance, comprehending itself, its teachings, and its destiny pervading all of Yisrael's members and engendering the fullest life in this spirit. Then, too, the offshoot that came forth from Yisrael, Christianity, will have completed its mission, and a battle of a different nature will have been concluded among our non-Jewish brethren, a battle in which man's gaze freely lifted up to the One alone, and his consciousness of moral strength will have overcome whatever threatened to obscure his insight and to corrupt his moral vigor. Then at last, the book of history will impress its final teachings upon every human mind. Let us understand the times in which we live, dear Benjamin. Right, according to what we have learned, Refersh strongly feels that you have to understand the world around you. That's essential. And let everyone further the progress of our age toward its goal, which refers to the freedoms and equalities of mankind, which is an axiom of the Torah, as we discussed this already by the French Revolution and modernity. But this probably also is a reference to man's ability to think, as we're going to see now. Let's start the paragraph over. Let us understand the times in which we live, dear Benjamin. Let everyone further the progress of our age according to its goal, each according to the powers of the mind granted to him, and within his circle, be it large or small. Even if thousands will forsake the cause of life and light, if thousands will turn their back on the destiny and name of Yisrael, whose way of life they abandoned long ago, the cause of truth is not concerned with the numbers of its adherents. Even if only one remains, one single Jew holding the book of the Torah in his hand, Yisrael's teachings in his heart, and Yisrael's radiance in his spirit, that one Jew suffices, and the cause of Yisrael will not be lost. So we know that we are to be the least of all the nations. Truth does not need large numbers backing it up. There are millions and millions of Arabs and Christians, Hindus, etc. in the world. And it's really not of a concern for us. As Rav Hirsch says in the next paragraph, Moshe alone was supposed to continue the entire nation. When Yisrael had become unfit for its mission, the One alone desired that the destiny and teaching of Yisrael be carried forward by one man, Moshe. As for us, if we were to falter, the prophet calls to us. And this comes from Yeshaya 51, 1 and 2. Shimu elai rodfei tzedek mevakshei Hashem, habitu el tzur chutzavtem, vel makeves bor nukartem, habitu el Avraham avichem, vel sarah tichol elchem, ki achad kirosiv va'avorchehu ve'arbehu. Gaze upon the rock from which you were hewn, upon the fountain hollowing mallet with which you were carved. Look upon Avraham your father, upon Sarah, who is destined to bear you. Only one was he when I called him. I blessed him and made him many. Farewell, dear Benjamin. Train yourself to become such a man. Farewell. So Rav Hirsch calls upon Benjamin to train himself, as it takes work to understand and implement this entire system. But every single type of Jew has his or her place. The Torah speaks to all of us in our own individual ways. And this concludes letter 18, part 4, and finally, the entire letter 18.